Her foal was gone. The ants hadn't touched anything else either, just made for this one soft and helpless thing, and then disappeared into the night. Why? I thought again and again, as if there really were someone who could answer me. The next morning I couldn't stand even the thought of lessons, and fled the house, out past the paddocks to a narrow path that twisted steeply down the hill. When I reached the Kip village, my lungs burned, and my bare legs were covered with welts from the thorn bushes and elephant grass. But I already felt better for being there. I always had, even when I was too young to lift the latch on the fence. The thorn bushes that knitted the fence together were as high as the shoulders of large oxen, and kept everything protected from the dangers of the bush. The low-lying huts and prized oxen, the shaggy bleating goats, and blackened cooking pots over licking flames, and children. That afternoon, a string of totos were playing a training game with bows and arrows, kneeling in the hammered dust, each trying to get closest to a target made of tied-together leaves. Kibii was at the center of the line, and though his black eyes glanced towards me with curiosity, he went on with the game, while I squatted down nearby. Most of the totos were very good with a still target. The arrows were fashioned out of whittled twigs with barbed points that stuck fast when they reached their target, as they were meant to. I watched them, wishing, as I'd done so many times before, that I'd been born a Kip. Not one of the girls, with their endless cooking duties, or their burdens of baskets, water, food stores, babies. The women did all the carrying and the hoeing, the weaving and plowing. They cared for the animals, too, while the warriors hunted or prepared for the hunt, oiling their limbs with rendered fat, plucking small hairs off their chests with tweezers kept in pouches around their necks. These totos kneeling on the ground would one day aim not at gourds, but bush pig, steenbok, lion. What could be more thrilling? When everyone had mastered one level, one of the older totos took another smaller target, also made of leaves, but rolled into a round gourd shape, and pitched it into the air, away from his body. The arrows flew, some landing, but most not. There were jibes and ridicule for those who missed most disastrously, but no one gave up. Again and again the youth pitched the gourd into the air, the totos releasing their arrows, until everyone had succeeded. Only then was the game finished. When Kibii finally trotted over and sat beside me, I told him what had happened to the foal. He was still holding his curved bow and handful of slender arrows. He pushed the tip of one into the stiff earth and said, "The Siafu are a plague." "What good are they? What god would make such a thing?" "It's not for us to know," he said, with a gentle shrug. "We do wonder, though." I looked at him and swallowed once, hard, feeling certain that I wasn't going to cry here, not in front of Kibii, and glad for it. Softness and helplessness got you nothing in this place. Tears only emptied you out. I stood up and straightened my shoulders, and then convinced Kibii he should let me have a try with his bow. My father had said Mrs. O would be our housekeeper, but even from the first day she behaved like something more. Like his wife, or like my mother. She had opinions about everything, and most particularly my stubbornness. Within a few months, she had had enough of trying to be my governess. My father was going to hire one from town. "Emma shouldn't have to struggle to keep you at your desk, Beryl," he told me. "It's not fair." I felt heat prickle along the tops of my ears. "I don't need a governess. I'll do the lessons."
"It's already done. This is for the best. You'll see."
A horrible woman named Miss LeMay was found for me, and then another when a dead black mamba happened to turn up in Miss LeMay's bed. All told, three governesses failed, as well as a handful of tutors, and my father finally seemed to give up on the idea. No more tutors appeared on the horizon, and I began to believe I had won and felt pleased with myself for battling so well. At the end of October, I turned 12. Not long after, my father arranged for us to go away for a few days, just the two of us. Though the trip was for business and had nothing to do with me, I was glad to be invited along, since the alternative would have been to stay at home alone with Mrs. O. We headed for Nairobi by train to settle some dealings my father had there with the bank. When we were finished in town, we went north to Kabete Station to visit my father's friend, Jim Elkington, on his ranch at the edge of the Kikuyu Reserve. As we rode, I sang out bits of Swahili and Bantu tunes. Twende, twende, kupigana, went one warrior song I loved. Let us go to fight. When I tired of my own voice, I asked my father to tell me stories. In general, he was close-lipped, hoarding his words as if he were afraid someone would make off with them. But he was different when we rode. He seemed to like to talk then. He would tell me the Greek myths he remembered from his time at school, the titans and heroes and various gods, thrilling depictions of the underworld. At other times he spoke of the generations of tribal wars between the Maasai and Kikuyu, fierce battles and cunning, nighttime victories, or about how to hunt and to survive. To shoot a charging elephant, you stood your ground and aimed between its eyes. If you missed the brain, you wouldn't live to attempt your shot again. For a puff adder, you backed away as soundlessly as possible, a few inches at a time, trying not to let your heart persuade you into panicking. For the deadlier black mamba, you ran flat out. A man could always outrun a mamba, but would never survive a fully landed strike. The day we rode out to Kabete Station, my father's mind was on lions.
A lion has more natural intelligence than most men, he said, pushing his bush hat back off his forehead with a fingertip.
He wore khakis for riding, a light cotton shirt, trousers the color of sand, and boots that would have had a high polish in the English countryside, but here were rinsed with layers of red silt.
He also has more courage than a man, and more determination. He'll fight for what belongs to him, no matter the size or strength of his rival. If the rival has a drop of cowardice in him, he's dead already.
I wanted him to go on talking, all the way to the Elkingtons and even further. If I just listened hard enough, I thought I might one day know everything he did. What if two equal lions battle for territory, or for a mate?
They'll each size up the other, testing the odds. A lion is more cautious on equal footing, but even then he won't back down. He has no fear, you see, not as we understand it. He can only be exactly what he is, what his nature dictates, and nothing else.
I wonder if this can be true of the Elkington's lion, said Bishan Singh, our Sikh groom.
He had journeyed with us to care for the horses, and rode just behind with my father's man, Gimutai.
That damned animal makes me nervous, my father answered. I don't mind telling you. It's unnatural for a wild creature to be kept like that.
I like Paddy, I said, remembering how I'd once seen Jim Elkington rub him like a cat. He's a good lion.
Which only proves my point, my father said, while behind us, Bishan Singh clucked his agreement. You can take a cub from the savannah as they have, and raise it like a pet if you like, in a cage as some do, or running free like Paddy. You can feed it fresh meat so it never learns to hunt, and brush its coat so it carries a human smell wherever it goes. But know that what you've done is twist something natural into something else, and you can never trust an unnatural thing. You don't know what it is, and it's baffled too.
Poor damned animal, he said again, and blew air up towards his nose to clear away some of the dust. The Elkington's house had leaded glass windows and a pretty veranda that backed onto absolute wilderness, a 1,000 miles or more of untamed Africa. There was a feeling, as you sat and ate your nice sandwich or had your tea, that you were on the slowly tipping edge of nothingness and might fall forward at any moment, and that if you did, it was possible that nothing would know you'd ever been there at all. Jim Elkington was round and red-faced and even-tempered. His wife wore a straw boater and white blouses she kept crisp and civilized-looking, somehow, even with a rawhide whip tucked into her belt. The whip was for Paddy, who roamed about the property as if he owned it. In the clearest sort of way, he did. Who would challenge him, after all? He'd been like a puppy once, thick-pawed, wrestling Jim on the lawn. But now he was full-grown, his ruff of mane black-tipped and glossy. The whip was only a prop. The last time I had seen Paddy, Jim Elkington had fed him a string of skinned rabbits on a pike as we watched. The lion rested flat with his paws crossed, full-shouldered and rust-colored, with black lips and jowls. He had enormous golden eyes and seemed aware of the picture he made as he let the dainties come to him. There was a wrinkled place above his perfectly square nose, which made him look puzzled or even a little amused by us. As we settled our horses, I didn't see Paddy, but I could hear him off somewhere, maybe miles away, roaring. It was a tortured sound, and also a little mournful, stiffening the fine hairs on the back of my neck. "He sounds lonely," I said. "Rot," my father said. "More like a howling banshee." "I don't hear it any more," Mrs. Elkington said, and then led us to her tea. Small, nice-smelling ginger cakes, dried fruit, potato dumplings in crisped skins that were eaten with your fingers, and good China tea in a pot. Jim had made a pitcher of cocktails with rye whiskey and crushed lemons. He stirred the pitcher with a glass rod, rare ice tinkling like crystal teardrops. The veranda was airless that day, and the conversation stultifying. I sighed and picked at a second ginger cake until my father finally gave me a look and a nod. "Go on, then," as he and Jim rose to go towards the stables. Mrs. Elkington tried to ply me with a dice game, but I made off as quickly as I could, flinging my shoes and stockings into the grass and hurrying across the long yard. I went out into the open country running fast, just to feel myself do it. Their land was much like ours, with dry grasses, dusty green and gold, and the rolling plains studded with thorn and flame trees, or sometimes a single fat baobab. Away in the distance I could see the cloud-softened crags of Mount Kenya, and thought how wonderful it would be to run there, 100 miles away, of how proud my father would be when I returned, and how Kibiyi would be sick with jealousy. Ahead of me there was a low hill with gooseberry bushes on top. I made a beeline for them, only half noticing a place in the grass where something large had slept recently, crushing the stems all around into a curved, pressed-down mold. I had my eyes on the hill, and didn't think of anything else, or know that I was being watched as I ran, stalked from behind like a young gazelle or Kongoni. I picked up speed, scrambling over the rise, and that's when I felt a force of air push at me, hot and meaty. The blow was like a steel pipe aimed at the muscles of my back. I went down hard, face first in the grass, my arms coming up instinctively to protect myself. I didn't know how long Paddy had been watching me. He'd smelled me first, possibly before I'd left the veranda. Maybe he'd only been curious about my girl smell, or maybe he'd started hunting me then. It didn't really matter, because he had already overpowered me. Paddy's jaw closed on my thigh above the knee. I felt his dagger teeth and his wet tongue, the strangely cool feel of his mouth. My head swam as I smelled my own blood, and then he released me to bellow. It was everything I'd heard from the veranda and more,
a vibrating black cave of noise that swallowed the earth and sky and swallowed me too. I closed my eyes and tried to scream, but only released a puff of air. I felt Paddy's mouth again and knew I had no chance at all. He would eat me here or drag me off to a glade or valley only he knew of, a place from which I'd never return. The last thought I remember having was, this is how it feels then. This is what it means to be eaten by a lion. Chapter 6. When I came back to myself, Bishan Singh was carrying me in his arms, his face bent over mine. I didn't want to ask about Paddy and where he'd gone, or to know how hurt I was. Blood dripped from a long gash along my leg onto Bishan Singh's white cotton tunic. My father had been with the horses, but when he came running, he held me close, crushing me to his chest. It was like being rescued again, really, because that had happened already. Bishan Singh had seen me run past him as he tended our horses in the Elkington stable. When he came up the hill, Paddy was already standing on my back, his mouth stretched wide, lips rimmed in black, teeth slick with saliva. He roared again, the sound nearly stopping Bishan Singh and the 6 or 7 grooms that came running up behind him, all of them trying to make their bodies appear larger and their voices boom. Then came Bwana Elkington, rolling his huge frame, flicking the long kiboko whip out in front of him like a cresting wave, the tip electrifying the air. The lion did not like being disturbed, Bishan Singh said, but Bwana lashed the whip hard again. He rushed at Paddy and screamed, striking him with the whip over and over. And finally Paddy had enough. He lunged at his master so quickly there was nothing for Bwana Elkington to do but to race to the baobab. He flew up that tree, and Paddy roared like Zeus himself. Then he was gone. The wound running from my calf muscle to the top of my thigh burned as if I were holding it over flames. I could feel each of the deep, raw claw marks from where Paddy had stood on my back, and the smaller punctures on my neck, under my blood-soaked hair. After the doctor was called, my father went into the other room and talked in sharp whispers to Jim and Mrs. Elkington about what should be done about Paddy. A little while later, a toto came running in from a nearby farm, saying that Paddy had killed a neighbor's horse and dragged it away. Jim and my father loaded up their rifles, ordering the grooms to ready their hacks, while I felt a swirl of emotions. Paddy was on the loose now. Part of me worried he could come back to the farm and attack someone, anyone. Another part of me felt awful for Paddy. He was a lion, and killing was what he'd been made to do. The doctor gave me laudanum, and then stitched me up with a hooked needle and thick black thread. I lay on my stomach, while Bishan Singh held one of my hands, his thin steel bangle rocking up and down his arm, his white turban wrapped around and around who knew how many times, and the end tucked invisibly somewhere, like the fabled snake that swallows its own tail. "The whip shouldn't have been more than a nut for Paddy," Bishan Singh told me. "What do you mean? What is a whip to a lion? He must have been ready to let you go. Or perhaps you weren't ever meant for him." I felt the tug of the needle, a pushing and pulling, as if just that part of my body were caught in a small current. His words were another kind of current. "What am I meant for, then?" "How wonderful that question is, Beru." He smiled mysteriously. "And as you did not die on this day, you have more time in which to answer it." I stayed with the Elkingtons for several weeks, while Mrs. Elkington brought me nice food on a bamboo tray, candied ginger, deviled eggs, and chilled juices. She had her kitchen Toto busy making me fresh cakes every day, as if that would somehow make up for what Paddy had done, and for the fact of him now, roaring sullenly and sometimes monstrously from a wooden pen behind the main paddock. They'd finally caught him 4 days after he escaped, and brought him back bound. When Mrs. Elkington told me he was behind bars, it was meant to reassure me, but it also turned my stomach. I had tempted Paddy by running in front of his nose, and now he was suffering for doing something that was natural for him. It was my fault, but there was also the matter, when I lay in my narrow bed at the Elkingtons, of Paddy's howling. I clamped my hands over my ears, relieved that he was locked away. Relieved and also sick about it. Safe and also guilty. When I could finally travel by cart to Nairobi, and then home to Njoro by train, it was as though I'd finally been released from a prison of my own, one made of Paddy's awful noises. But I didn't truly stop thinking about Paddy, or dreaming terrible dreams about him, until I was able to tell Kibiyi what had happened. He and some of the other Totos sat as still as posts, while I drew every detail out, my story growing longer and more harrowing, and me growing braver, steelier, a hero or warrior instead of something that had been hunted and only narrowly rescued. Every Kipsigis Moran in training had to hunt and kill a lion in order to earn his spear. If he failed, he would live in shame. If he succeeded, nothing could be more magnificent. Beautiful women would sing his name, and his deed would pass into history. In verses his own children would learn and act out in games. I had always been wildly jealous that Kibiyi could look forward to so much daring and glory, and couldn't help but feel a little satisfied now that I had survived something he hadn't yet faced. And the truth was, no matter how I embellished or shaped the story of what had happened with Paddy, it had happened, and I had lived to tell the tale. That alone had a powerful effect on me. I felt slightly invincible, that I could come through nearly anything my world might throw at me. But of course, I had no idea what lay in store.
Emma and I think you should go to school in Nairobi, my father said a few weeks after I had returned home from the Elkingtons.
His tented fingers rested on the dinner table. I jerked up to look at him.
Why not another governess?
You can't run wild forever. You need schooling.
I can learn here at the farm. I won't fight anymore, I promise.
It's not safe here for you, don't you see? Mrs. O said from her chair. Her untouched tableware gleamed, mirroring back chips of red light from the hurricane lamp, and it struck me all at once that all of this was happening because I had never found a way to properly best her. I had grown used to her ways. I'd been distracted by foals and gallops and hunting games with Kibiyi, but she hadn't grown used to me.
If you mean Paddy, that should never have happened.
Of course it shouldn't have. Her violet eyes narrowed.
But it did. You seem to think you're invulnerable, running around half naked with those boys, out in the bush where anything could get you. Anything. You're a child, though no one around here seems to know it.
I clenched my fists and brought them down hard on the edge of the table. I yelled all sorts of things and pushed away my plate and sent my tableware clattering to the floor.
You can't force me to go,
I finally cried, my throat hoarse, my face hot and swollen feeling.
It's not up to you, my father said, his mouth stern and unyielding.
The next morning, I woke at first light and rode to Equator Ranch to see Lady D. She was the kindest and most reasonable person I knew. She would have some sort of solution, I believed. She would know what to do.
Daddy seems set, I began to rant before I was halfway through the door. But he's only going along with Mrs. O. She told him that I'm going to be torn to ribbons by another lion if I keep going like this. But she doesn't really care. I'm in her way. That's really what it is.
Lady D led me to a comfortable place on her carpet and let me spit out everything without stopping for breath. Finally, when I had settled down a little, she said, I don't know Emma's reasons or Klutz, but I for one will be proud to see you come back a young lady. I can learn what I need to learn here. She nodded. She had a way of doing that, warmly, even when she disagreed with every word you said. Not everything. One day you'll think differently about education and be glad for it. She reached for one of my hands, gently pried it from my lap, and turned it over in hers. Proper learning isn't just useful in society, Beryl. It can be wonderfully yours. A thing to have and keep just for you. I probably scowled at her or at the wall because she gave me a look flooded with incredible patience. I know this feels like the end of the world, she went on, but it isn't. So much will happen to you. So much. And it's all out in the world ahead of you. Her fingertips moved in slow circles in the center of my palm, lulling me. Before I quite knew it, I began to nod off, tucking in beside her, my head on her lap. When I woke a bit later, she got up and asked the houseboy to bring us tea. Then we sat at her table, thumbing through the giant atlas I loved, the page falling open to a broad map of England, green as a jewel. Do you think I'll ever go there? I asked. Why wouldn't you? It's still your home. Running my fingertips over the page, I traced the names of towns that were both foreign and familiar. Ipswich and Newquay, Oxford, Manchester, Leeds. Does your mother ever write to you from London? She asked. No, I said, feeling a little disorientated. No one ever mentioned my mother, and life was so much easier that way. I could tell you things about her if you ever want to know. I shook my head. She doesn't matter now. Only the farm does. Lady D looked at me for a long moment, seeming to mull this over. I'm sorry. It's not my place to pry. A short while later, D blustered in, kicking off dust and talking to himself. My favorite girls! He cheered. Beryl's had a bit of a day, Lady D warned him. She's going to go off to school soon, in Nairobi. Ah! He settled himself gruffly in a chair opposite me. I wondered when that would come up. You'll be grand at it, girl. Really you will. I've always said you were as sharp as a tack.
I'm not so sure. I made a half-hearted attempt to finish my tea, which had grown cold.
Swear you'll come and see us whenever you can. You have a home here, too. You always will.
When I said goodbye, Lady D walked me out to the stable and put her hands on my shoulders. There's no girl quite like you, Beryl, and you're going to do well in Nairobi. You'll do well anywhere. It was nearly dark when I reached the farm, and the mountains were an inky blue and seemed to shrink and flatten against the distance. Wee McGregor crested our hill, bringing us to the edge of the paddock, and I saw Kabee heading off towards the path to his village. I thought of calling out to him, but I'd had enough difficult talking for one day, and didn't know how to tell him I would be leaving soon. I didn't know how to say goodbye.
Chapter 7. Over the next 2.5 years, I did my best at school, though my best was hardly up to scratch. I ran away 6 times, once hiding in a pig hole for 3 days. Another time I sparked a rebellion that had most of the school bolting onto the plains after me on their bicycles. That got me sacked, finally. My father met my train looking cross, but also relieved, as if he understood that sending me away was never going to work. But the farm wasn't at all the place I had left. The world wasn't the same, actually, and the war had made certain of that. We had heard all the biggest bits of news at school.
About the Archduke's assassination, about Kaiser Wilhelm, and how nations we'd scarcely heard of had banded together to fight one another. For British East Africa, war meant stopping the land-greedy Germans from taking everything we believed was rightfully ours. Large portions of the Protectorate had become battlefields, and men everywhere, Boers and Nandis and white settlers, Kavirondo and Kipsigis warriors, had left their ploughs and mills and shambas to join the King's African Rifles. Even Arap Maina had gone off to fight. During one of my school holidays, Kibii and I stood together at the top of our hill to watch him march off to join his regiment. He held his spear high in one hand and his buffalo hide shield in the other, and carried himself straight and proud as he walked down the dirt track. He was sent hundreds of miles away, to the border of German East Africa, and handed a rifle in place of his spear. He didn't know how to use a gun, but of course he would master it. He was the bravest and most self-assured warrior I knew, and I was sure he'd come home with stories, and perhaps enough gold to buy a new wife. But before the end of that summer holiday, a messenger came running onto our farm one afternoon, and he told us what had happened so far away. Arap Maina had fought as bravely as he could, but he had died in that distant place, and was buried where he fell, without his tribe or family to honor him. Kibii's face revealed nothing when we heard the news, but he stopped eating and grew thin and angry. I didn't know how to comfort him or what to think. Arap Maina hadn't even seemed mortal, and now he was gone. "We should find the man who killed your father and plunge a spear into his heart," I told him. "It's my duty to do this, the moment I become a Moran." "I'll come with you," I told him. I had loved Arap Maina like my own father, and was ready to go anywhere and do anything to avenge his death. "You are only a girl, Lakwait." "I am not afraid. I can throw a spear as far as you can." "It's not possible. Your father would never part with you."
"I won't tell him then. I've run away before."
"Your words are selfish. Your father loves you, and he is alive. My father meant the world to me. When I was away, I had longed for him every bit as much as I had for the farm. But the war had worked its changes on him too. When he met my train, his face was so drawn and serious, I barely knew how to say hello. We motored up the long hill, and he explained that nearby Nakuru was now a garrison town. The racecourse had become a remounting and transport depot for the troops. Our horses had been conscripted into service, leaving our stables and paddocks more than half empty. But it didn't matter since all the race meetings were suspended for the duration. As soon as we reached the crest, I could see the difference for myself. Hundreds of our workers had gone off with only the clothes on their backs and any weapons they had, guns or spears or bush knives, and some confused idea of glory or honor. The Empire had called, and so now they were soldiers of the crown. It was possible they would be back soon, but for the moment, it was as if someone had turned Green Hills over like a box and shaken its contents out onto the hard ground, where they'd blown away. In the main house, Mrs. O had made a meal for my homecoming and dressed for it. She was as tidy and pressed as ever, but there were strands of silver along her temples and fine lines around her eyes, and I found I was seeing her in a new way. My bunkmate for most of the time I was at school was a girl named Doris Waterman, though she liked to be called Doss. Night after night, she'd lean down from her bunk over mine to whisper things, her straight brown hair falling around her face in a curtain. She told me she was an only child, and that her father owned a string of shops in town. He also owned the New Stanley Hotel, which was an important gathering place for anyone coming through Nairobi.
Anything that happened there, or anywhere nearby, Doss seemed to know.
Mrs. Orchardson,
she'd said quizzically when I mentioned her in passing.
Is her husband still in Lombois? What? She's not married. She's been living with my father for years.
Doss made a clucking sound at my innocence, and then proceeded to tell me how, years before, Mr. Orchardson, who was an anthropologist, had taken a Nandi woman for a lover, and that she had become pregnant. I was shocked.
How do you know that?
She shrugged, still half-tipped over the bunk.
Everyone knows. It's not something that happens every day. So Mrs. O came to us? To escape her situation there? Njoro wouldn't be far enough from Lumbwa for me. It's so humiliating. And now she and your father aren't even married.
It was as if there'd been clouds over my eyes. Puffy and purely white. I hadn't known anything about the world of adults, or the number of thorny things that could happen between men and women. I hadn't been paying attention. But now the clouds fell away in an instant, leaving the hard facts. My father must have known about Mr. Orchardson and the Nandi woman, and either not cared or not given in to worrying about what the connection meant for him. Their current living arrangement was more scandalous than I ever imagined, for she was still married. Perhaps my father was, too. I'd never given the matter much attention, but I did now, feeling that their relationship was another thing that had grown infinitely more complicated in a very complicated world. "When will the war end?" I asked my father. At school, everyone kept saying how the fighting is just preventative. Bright sunlight glinted through the glazed window panes on the simple tea service and the oilcloth and hearthstones and cedar panels. Each object was the same as it had been, but the air all around felt different. I was different.
They do say that, don't they? And yet the casualties keep mounting. 20,000 in Africa alone.
Will you go off to fight? I had a hard time keeping my voice steady asking it.
No, I promise I won't. But Dee has joined up.
When? Why? Surely there are enough men already. My father and Mrs. O exchanged a meaningful look. Daddy? What's happened? Has Dee been wounded? It's Florence, Mrs. O said. She fell very ill not long after your last visit. Her heart gave out. There was nothing wrong with her heart. She was always as fit as a horse. No, my father said slowly, with great care.
She'd actually been ill for years. No one knew but Dee.
I don't understand. Where is she now? My father looked at the backs of his hands. The color had drained from his face.
She died, Beryl. 6 months ago. She's gone.
6 months? Why did you keep it from me?
We didn't want to tell you in a telegram, my father said. But I don't know. Maybe we were wrong to wait.
She was a wonderful woman, Mrs. O said. I know you loved her very much. I could only look at her numbly. I pushed my chair back and made my way to the stable in a sort of trance, feeling undone. How many dozens of hours had I sat on Lady Dee's carpet, drinking her tea and soaking up her words, never knowing she was ill or even weak? Maybe I hadn't known her at all, not really, and now she was gone. I wouldn't ever see her again. I'd never even said goodbye. In the shabby stable office, I found Buller napping and dropped to my knees, rubbing my face against his brindled coat. He was completely deaf now, and because he hadn't heard me, he was startled, but also happy. He sniffed me everywhere and licked my face, wriggling all the way to his tail. When he flopped to the beaten earth again, I lay my head on him, looking around at my father's things. His desk with the thick black stud book,
his riding helmet and crop, a plate full of pipe ash, yellowed newspapers, and the calendar on the wall. There should have been important dates circled in red. The stable should have been alive with activity, but it was as still as a Nandi burial ground. I had finally come back for good, and yet Green Hills barely felt like home anymore. Would it again? After a while, my father came in and looked at us there on the floor.
I know she meant the world to you.
He paused.
This is a lot to come home to, but sooner or later it will all get sorted.
I was desperate to believe he was telling the truth, that the worst of our troubles were behind us, that everything that had tumbled into chaos could still be set right again. I wanted that as much as I had ever wanted anything. The war won't last forever, will it? I asked him, my voice catching.
It can't, he replied. Nothing does.
Part 2. Chapter 8. When the March rains fell over the plains and the ragged face of the escarpment, 6 million yellow flowers cracked open all at once. Red and white butterflies, the ones that look like peppermint sticks, flashed in twists against the sparkling air. But in 1919, the rains didn't come. Not the soaking April storms when one inky cloud could levitate for hours, spilling everything it had. And not the short daily November rains that winked on and off as if they ran on a system of pulleys. Nothing came that year. And the plains and the bush all went sand-coloured. Everywhere you looked seemed to shrink and curdle with dryness. Along the banks of Lake Nakuru, the waterline receded and collapsed, leaving powdery green mould and strange curls of dried lichen. The villagers were silent, their herds emaciated. My father scoured the horizon line like every other upcountry farmer within 100 miles of Nairobi, and saw no smudge of cloud anywhere, or even a single shadow on the sun. I was 16 now, and full of restless feelings. In his study, I watched my father cup his chin solemnly and stare into his ledger with hooded, bloodshot eyes. Scotch before breakfast. Neat. I leaned over the back of his chair to tuck my chin between his neck and shoulder. He smelled like hot cotton, like the sky. You should go back to bed.
I haven't been to bed.
No, I suppose you haven't. The night before, he and Emma—I had taken to calling her that since I'd come home—had been invited to a small evening party in Nakuru, racing types, I suspected. I didn't understand how Emma kept herself up so well on the farm. Though lined and softened, her skin was still fair. She was slim, and her clothes moved well when she walked, a thing I might have managed to pull off if I'd stayed at school with the other girls instead of here, in the middle of the bush, in slacks and dusty knee-high boots. "You really could make more of an effort, Beryl," Emma had said before they left for Nakuru. "Come to town with us." I was better off at home. After they roared down the dirt track in Daddy's Hudson, I tucked in by the cedarwood fire to read, liking and needing the quiet. But not long after I'd gone to bed, they were home again, whispering fiercely to each other as they crossed the yard from the car. He'd done something, or she thought he had, their voices growing louder and more tense, and I wondered what had set them off. Sometimes things in town could turn volatile if Emma felt snubbed. She'd been living openly as my father's common-law wife, but as I grew older I saw things that had been invisible to me before, like how even if she and Daddy seemed ready to throw off the usual conventions or at least ignore them, the colony at large couldn't. Many of the neighboring farmers' wives had effectively shut Emma out. Even in town, as I'd learned from Doss,
the arrangement was seen as disgraceful, no matter how much time had passed, no matter how conservative they seemed in other ways. But if tensions from the outside world stirred the pot at home, at least Emma seemed ready to drop any nonsense about my needing a governess or schooling. Her efforts now were aimed at my manners and appearance, such as they were. She was forever trying to get me to wash more, to wear a frock instead of trousers. Gloves were essential if I ever wanted to keep my hands nice, and didn't I know that any proper young lady wore a hat outdoors? She also seemed more insistent than ever that I shouldn't spend time with Kabii or any of the young men from the Kip village. It was bad enough when you were children, but now, well, it's not seemly. Seemly? I don't see what all the fuss is about.
Emma's right, my father agreed. It's just not done.
Though I continued to fight both of them on principle, the fact was I rarely saw Kabii now. When I came back to the farm from Nairobi, he began to walk 3 paces behind me when we went to the stables together for gallops.
What are you up to?
I asked the first time I noticed him doing it.
You are the Memsahib. This is what's proper.
I'm the same as I have been, you ninny. Stop it.
But we were neither of us the same as before, and I felt that as clearly as I saw the changes in my body when I undressed at night, the rounding and lengthening of my new curves. Kibi's arms and legs were muscled, where they'd once been soft and boyish, and his face had hardened too. I felt myself drawn to him, the polished look of his skin, and the strong length of his thigh beneath his shuka. He was beautiful, but when I tried to touch him casually, testing the waters, he flinched.
Stop, Beru!
Why not? Aren't you even a little curious?
Don't be stupid. Do you want to get me killed?
When he stormed off, I was left feeling stung and rejected. But deep down I knew he was right. Neither of our worlds would have permitted that sort of touch between us for a minute, and the situation could have quickly become terrible for both of us. But I missed Kabii. Things had once been so simple and good between us, when we weren't afraid of anything, when we'd hunted in perfect lockstep. I remembered running for miles looking for an occupied warthog hole with Arap Maina, and then stooping to crinkle paper outside the mouth of its den. This was what you did to call out the pig. The noise working to aggravate the animal in some way I didn't understand, but rarely saw fail. Kabii and I did everything Arap Maina asked of us, and came home with the body of a large boar slung between us like a fleshy hammock. The hair on its haunches was like crisp black wire. Its mouth was frozen and clenched in death, bearing an expression of stubbornness I admired. My end of the stick bit heavily into my hands and felt exactly right. This was what the pig weighed, what the day weighed. My God, how I wanted to live like that again. I wanted to see Arap Maina, to follow him soundlessly through jagged elephant grass, to laugh with Kabii lightly over anything or nothing. But he was nearly 15 now. When his circumcision ceremony arrived, he would become the warrior he was always meant to be. In all the time I'd known him, he'd never stopped dreaming of and longing for that day. But somehow, as I'd listened to him over the years, I'd managed to ignore how the ceremony would take away the boy I knew forever, and also the fierce warrior girl who had loved him. It already had. Those children were gone. Chapter 9. In his stable office, my father folded his ledger and reached for a drink, though he'd only recently finished his morning coffee.
"You're going to run Pegasus today?"
he asked me. "A mile and a quarter at half speed. His head's been a little low. I thought I'd try the chain snaffle."
"Good girl,"
he said. But his eyes were flat and detached as I ran through the rest of the morning's duties. Which of the horses were on gallop day,
which were resting or in tendon boots. The feed ordered, delivery scheduled. Since I'd failed at boarding school, this was my life. He organized the breeding and ran the farm, and I was his head boy. I wanted to be indispensable, but I would settle for being useful. The groom, Tumbo, had brushed Pegasus's coat to a lacquer and now boosted me into the saddle. At 2, Pegasus was massive already, a notch more than 17 hands. I was tall too, nearly 6 foot now, but I felt like a leaf in the saddle. In the yard, the morning was as clear as glass, the same as the last 10 or 20 or 100 mornings. We passed under the large wattle tree, where a pair of grey-whiskered vervets chattered from one of the lower branches. They looked like 2 old men with their leathery black hands and thin, disappointed faces. They'd come down from the forest or escarpment looking for water, but our cisterns had run desperately low, and we had none to offer. Over the hill, the dirt track stretched down and away through broadly terraced fields. In better days, our crops had spread around us in every direction, rich and green. When you walked through the chest-high maize, your foot would sink into the moist earth up to your ankle. Now the leaves curled and cracked. The mill still ran continuously, grinding posho that then waited in canvas bags to honor our contracts. Grain-filled rail carriages still streamed away from our station at Campi Yimoto towards Nairobi, but no one was getting rich from any of it. My father had borrowed against chits at high interest, and then borrowed more. The rupee was plummeting like a grouse full of bird shot. Where it was now, no one really knew. The creditors seemed constantly to change their minds, and my father's debt slid up and down a ladder almost daily. But our horses had to eat. They needed crimped oats, bran, boiled barley, not bleached patches of lucerne. My father had built his bloodstock from love and gut instinct, and the thick black studbook with lists of names going all the way back to sires like magnificent princes. These were the finest horses there were. He wasn't going to let anyone or anything take an inch more without a fight. Not after he had worked so hard. When Pegasus and I reached the open track, we paused and settled, getting our bearings. Then I opened him up. He charged out like a coiled spring, lengthening along the flat grade, thrusting through the rhythms of his stride, fast and perfect, close to flying. I had foaled him myself when I was 14, and home for a spring holiday, watching Coquette's trembling labor and overjoyed that I could be there for it. Coquette had delivered healthy foals every few years since the terrible birth of Apollo and the coming of the Siafu ants, but I still didn't want to leave her side for a moment, and took to sleeping in her loose box for the last few weeks. When the foal finally came, I broke open the slick, translucent birth sac with my hands and gently tugged him by his small, perfect front hoofs into the loose straw bed. I nearly shook with happiness and relief. It was the first time I'd ever been midwife on my own, and there'd been no mishaps. My father had trusted me, and didn't come into the stable at all until dawn, as I held Pegasus in my arms, a bundle of wet heat and bony folded limbs. "Well done," he said from the stable door. He seemed to know that even the dusty tip of his boot in the loose box would lessen what I'd carried off without him. "You brought him to life. I suppose he's yours now." Mine. I'd never owned anything, or thought I should, happily grooming, handling, feeding, and worrying over my father's animals for years. But somehow this miraculous animal belonged to me. A bit of grace I hadn't even known I was desperate for. When Pegasus and I finished our run, we made for home the long way, around the northern perimeter of the valley, where it furled out in an unbroken sweep. A neighbor had recently snapped up the adjoining parcel, and I saw signs of him now.
newly set fence posts stood as straight as matchsticks, where there'd been only open land and unmarred emptiness. I traced the line they made, and soon reached the farmer, hatless and barrel-chested, with a spool of wire over his shoulder. He was stringing it with a hammer and claw, and staples, the muscles of his arms going taut as he drew the wire hard against the post and secured it. He didn't stop working until Pegasus and I stood 5 feet from him. Then he smiled up at me, his collar dark with fresh perspiration.
"You're trampling my pasture."
I knew he was joking. There was no pasture yet, or much of anything finished, but I could tell it would all be marvelous one day. You could see it in the way he'd set the post so well.
"I can't believe your house is up," I said. It made it look more suited for town than the bush, with a shingle roof instead of thatch, and real glass at the windows.
"It's nothing like your father's place."
He'd already guessed who I was then. Shielding his eyes with the back of his arm, he squinted up at me.
"I met him years ago, when I was laid up near here with the Madras volunteers."
"You were wounded?"
"Dysentery, actually. My whole troop had it. Loads of men died."
"That sounds awful." "It was." The smallest hint of a Scottish brogue rolled from behind his tongue.
"But there were a few pleasures. One day some of us went off hunting down in the Rongai Valley, and you were there. A good-looking native boy was with you too, and you were both crack shots."
He smiled, flashing neat square teeth.
"You don't remember me."
I scanned his face, the squared-off jaw and strong chin and cornflower blue eyes, looking for something familiar.
"Sorry," I finally admitted. "There were so many soldiers around then." "You've grown up."
"Daddy says I might never stop growing. I passed him a while ago."
He smiled and continued to look up at me, in a way that made me wonder if there was something else I was meant to say or do. I couldn't imagine what. All I knew of men beyond farm life and work were the warm, confusing thoughts I sometimes had late at night now, about being touched or taken. Thoughts that could make my cheeks hot, even when I was alone in my hut.
"Well, it's nice to see you again."
He reached for his spool of wire without moving his eyes from mine. "Good luck," I told him, and then nudged Pegasus away, glad to be leaving him there with his fence posts, to be turning for home with the sun at my back.
"I met our new neighbor,"
I said at dinner that night, sawing at a slab of Thompson's gazelle steak with the tip of my knife.
"Purvis," my father said. "He's done a lot with that land."
"This is the ex-captain you were telling me about, Charles?"
Emma asked from her end of the table.
"He's a good-looking fellow. I saw him in town." "He's a hard worker, I'll say that."
"What did you think of him, Beryl?"
I shrugged. "He's all right, I suppose."
"It wouldn't kill you to make more of an effort socially," she said. "Do you know anyone your age?"
"My age? He has to be 30.
"Farm life is going to harden you, you know. You think you'll be young and beautiful forever, and that you'll have plenty of chances. But it doesn't work like that."
"She's only 16, Em," my father said. "She has plenty of time."
"That's what you think. We're not helping, keeping her out here with no company. School didn't do a thing. Not that she was there long. She's wild. She doesn't know how to make conversation. Why are we talking about manners in society when there are real problems to think about?"
I pushed my plate away in frustration.
"One day you will want to attract a man," Emma said, glaring at me pointedly. "Your father and I have to prepare you for that."
"Emma thinks you should have a coming-out party," he explained, cupping the heavy base of his scotch glass.
"You've got to be joking. Out where?"
"You know perfectly well these things are done, Beryl, even here. It's important to be known in society and to develop some grace. You might not think it matters now, but you will."
"I have all the society I need here," I said, meaning Buller and our horses.
It's one night, Beryl.
And a new dress, Emma added, as if this were any kind of draw. We've already